Welcome back to the Tradition Podcast. I'm your host, Jeffrey Sachs. Aviva Gottlieb-Zornberg is an internationally recognized teacher and lecturer around the English-speaking world and, each week, in multiple settings in and around Jerusalem, where her unique style of integrating keen readings of the weekly Torah portion with the commentaries of Midrash, classical Mefarshim, Hasidic interpretation, and more are supplemented by the insights she draws from psychoanalytical readings, literature, and culture at large, the best that's been thought and said, as it were. Her work has inspired generations of her many students and has produced a very rich body of 6 volumes on biblical books and themes. Tradition's Winter 2021 issue featured her essay on love, holiness, and the other, and channeling the work of psychoanalyst Jonathan Lear and Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, the command to aspire as an ethical imperative. That chapter has now appeared as part of a larger essay in her most recent book, The Hidden Order of Intimacy, Reflections on the Book of Leviticus, which appeared last year from Shokan. As the Jewish world commences our annual reading of Leviticus, or Vayikra, this week, we thought it would be a good time to catch up with Aviva and talk about her new book, the unusual way it came about, what I termed the atmosphere she breathes in order to produce works of Torah scholarship that bring together such wide-ranging voices. We also talked about the possibly troubling state of the humanities in the world today and within Jewish learning in particular. On Love, Holiness, and the Other, which centers on Parashat Kedoshim, can be accessed in the archives of traditiononline.org. While you're there, sign up for our newsletter, or renew or gift a subscription to our Journal of Jewish Thought. And now, here's my conversation with Aviva Zornberg on The Hidden Order of Intimacy. Welcome to the Tradition Podcast, Dr. Aviva Gottlieb-Zornberg.
Welcome, Jeffrey Sachs. Thank you very much for having me.
Nice to see you. In our Winter 2021 issue, we were very pleased to publish what we hope will be the first of more essays from your pen. It was an essay called Of Love, Holiness, and the Other, a reflection on themes in Parashat Kedoshim. And that essay later became part of a larger chapter in your book, which was released last year, The Hidden Order of Intimacy, Reflections on the Book of Leviticus from the Shokan Press. So this is one of your now number of books that you've written exploring large themes and ideas in the biblical text. You, of course, have a book on Genesis and a book on Exodus and a book on Numbers, and as well as a book about the character, the personality of Moses, of Moshe Rabbeinu, as part of the Jewish Live series. And now you bring us a sacrifice, as it were, on the book of Leviticus. But you admit in the introduction that this came as something of a surprise. You had not initially planned to write on the book of Leviticus. So tell us a little bit about that and how the book came to being, because it's an interesting story, I think.
Well, it's an interesting story, and I think it's a typical story for many people that when we get to Vayikra, something seems much less engaging in Sefer Vayikra than in the other Svarim. To those of us, certainly, whose life and sensibility is focused on the humanities, and we are looking for something that is not legal, technical, detail heavy. We're looking for larger meanings. So I took it as a kind of given. And I really had not taught Sefer Vayikra very much over the years, because that was the time of year that I did my annual American tour. So I missed those weeks. But partly thanks to my husband, who thought I could do it, I did have material for it. I began to look again at the Midrash, and I was really overwhelmed. It was a surprise how much material that is exactly what I'm looking for there is in the Midrash on Vayikra, particularly on the opening section of Vayikra and the whole idea of God calling to Moshe towards this new role that has to do with the Mishkan. And there was such a wealth of material that I really enjoyed the process very much. What I found was that since I didn't have all that much taught material, material that I had actually worked on throughout year by year on Vayikra, as I had on the other Svarim, I had a certain amount, but not much. What I was doing really was more a pure writing process rather than simply pulling out the essence of years of teaching. I was going back with a kind of fresh eye, without a written, without notes in front of me, and somehow creating what I wanted to create in a more purely literary way, I would say.
Well, I think we should mention for our listeners that that may not have had the pleasure or maybe aren't here in Jerusalem and have greater access to your teaching, that you teach in multiple settings throughout each week. And very, very much of your teaching is organized around the teaching of that week's parasha, which you do. You'll give the same shiur in a few different settings, tailoring it presumably to each audience. And then year after year, you come around and you revisit parasha Vayikra again and again, and that's how you develop a kind of repertoire of thinking and material and teaching and speaking on each parasha. And that was the genesis of your books until now. And this book, of course, you mentioned in the introduction, was something of a lockdown project while we were all huddled at home during COVID. You know, some people, my project was to eat a lot of ice cream and gain a certain amount of weight, and you produce works of Torah scholarship. Everybody has their own strength, I suppose. But that process, the generative process of this book, when you look at it, do you feel that it came out somehow differently because it originated in a different place and through a different method?
I don't know if I'm the best person to judge, but I think from my point of view, yes. I think there is, as I say, more of a literary consciousness in it. I know I'm sort of creating, not me, Ayin, but I'm creating with less ready material. Right. And so the ideas are actually getting clothed in words on the spot rather than already being there somewhere in the background.
Right. One of the interesting things in your books on each of the Chumashim, there's no end to books on the parasha, but I don't think most readers would confuse your books for these kinds of collections of things that maybe begin as sermons or drashot, or where really each chapter stands alone. And maybe the reader can intuit that, you know, this author has certain interests which pop up again and again. This author relies on certain mifurshim that came before him or her, and therefore it won't be surprising that because of the author's affections for Nitziv or Ramban, those two mifurshim will have greater length in the index. In your works, you're, I would say, synthesizing great swaths of the humanities, together with, of course, Torah scholarship, the classical Mefarshim, the very significant eye towards the Midrash. And very often we'll identify a theme that runs throughout the parashiot of the Chumash in the book. And in this volume on Vayikra, you actually turn your attention back to the end of Shemot, the end of Exodus, Parsha. We're now recording now in mid-March. Listeners will be reading this, listening to this, or watching this episode while we're beginning the reading of Vayikra, but they will no doubt remember that we've just read the long story of the Chet HaEgel, the golden calf. And you present an idea, like all works of genius, once you hear it, it seems so obvious, and you scratch your head and think, well, why didn't I think of that or see it until Aviva Zornberg pointed it out to me? But you point out the degree to which the Chet HaEgel, the golden calf, appears woven sometimes, you know, behind the weave throughout, between the lines of Sefer Vayikra. And I want to look, if you have it in front of you, the very last paragraph of of the introduction. You describe the idea, you encapsulate the idea. I'd like you to read it because we just love hearing your voice. And I should mention that there's an audio book version in your your lilting Scottish accent, which is worth listening to for people that that would like to experience the book in that way. So so read for us that conclusion to your introduction.
In this book, I read Leviticus through the prism of Midrashic narratives that connect the surface with the depths of this text. Following my original intuition that the golden calf pervades that space, I find, sometimes to my own surprise, how often the calf, as the moment of slippage in human life, does make its appearance. As in dreams, the details of law and ritual turn out to be haunted by something repetitious, a sense of nameless loss, and by a secondary revelation of a different kind, which involves time and work and the birth of compassion.
I think that's just such a beautiful formulation of what you're trying to get at in this book, and something that I saw in the chapters that I've read, and particularly in the chapter that, you know, we worked on together, you as author and I in a very secondary role as editor, the chapter on Parashat Kedoshim, which appeared in tradition, but in the book is paired together as part of a larger analysis of the twinned parashiot Achrimot v'Kedoshim. So in Achrimot, we have, of course, the description of the Se'er la'Azazel, the scapegoat, which you turn your attention to, and you find in it what you call residues of the golden calf. So maybe you can demonstrate for our listeners how these themes connect and produce the new insights that you offer.
Well, I think before approaching the Seir la'Azazel, the goat that gets massacred in the wilderness, gets shattered in the wilderness, which is an extreme instance of violence committed upon an animal. But of course, that has all kinds of resonances. The scapegoat is usually, in human affairs, a human being, not an animal. And this is a symbolic representation of extreme violence in a society. Maybe we'll get to that after. I would think it's worth going back to the golden calf, which is connected with the calf, the goat. They are both classic idols of the calf and the goat. These are the stereotypical idols of the ancient Near East and of Egypt in particular. And as for the calf, what I would want to say about it is that it represents, how shall I put it, that it represents, well, everyone knows it's simply the sin of idolatry, and that's forbidden, and that was the major sin. But I'm looking for something deeper. What does the calf represent in terms of meaning? What is idolatry, really? And I take off from, I think, passages in the great Hasidic commentary, the Sfat Emet, who simply talks about how hard it was for the people to free themselves of the constrictions and the slavery of Egypt, even once they're out of it, that it haunts them. It has like a wire in the blood, you know, it's like a vibration in the blood. And he calls that idolatry. Idolatry is a constriction. It's mitzrayim mitzarim. It's the essence of constriction, of narrowing of one's interests, and of a kind of compulsive, really the word I want is fetishizing of objects. You make of an object the source of all power in your life. In a way, you surrender all your own freedom to that object as you project on it. And God is, in a way, to be seen in that framework, that God represents the alternative, which is an almost unthinkable alternative. It's much easier to worship idols than to get rid oneself of those tsirim, those constrictions, those narrowings of human effort, which have a certain power for us. We need it. And that is the long story of the golden calf. And so what I try to show is that this lingering effect of the golden calf is there in the Torah itself quite explicitly. For instance, there is the Pasuk, there is the verse at the end of the story when God has already forgiven the people officially. He says, all right, I will not destroy them right away, all right away, as you have asked me, Moshe, I've forgiven according to your plea, but in every generation, keep a biyom pokdi efkod, on the day that I
we'll
visit
parcel
punishment.
Out the punishment.
Yes, I'll
history.
Parcel out. Thank you. Yes, it'll come by installments, in very small installments. I would hardly notice it, as it were. Every time there's some bill to be paid off, there'll be a little bit of that. Any nice words that are used, unki or ma'at or ketzat, just a little bit. An alchemical kind of almost theoretical amount. And to me, that suggests very strongly that it's not just the punishment that will be parceled out, but that the sin itself will remain endemic in some very minor amount, just enough to keep us a little uneasy, a little tempted throughout our history. Yeah. And I see that as what lies behind many, many of the Midrashic readings of Sefer Mikra.
But I think this is a lovely example to understand something about your own, both your own interests and your own method. I know from previous conversations that you and I have had, you don't very much enjoy talking about your method. In other words, the question of how our interests in Torah, our interests in Midrash and Hasidut, our interests in literature or in psychoanalysis or whatever each of us has on our shelves, and the way that our reading and the thinking of others that we carry around with us impacts our own thought is kind of like asking, a fish, how's the water? What do you mean? It's just the atmosphere in which we live. And we not only do we tend not to think about it that much, but it's not always so healthy to think about it, to overthink it. And when you pack enough richness into the atmosphere around us, it tends to have an impact and come out in our work in fascinating ways. But nevertheless, this insight that you just offered, which sits at the intersection of the biblical text, the Midrashic reading, the Hasidic reading of the Sfat Emet, who actually, plays a very significant role in your work and appears, not infrequently. And then on top of that, the insights of psychoanalysis, it produces a very interesting reading. So, even though I've tried to engage you on this topic on occasion in the past, can you help us understand how that all works for you? What are the elements that make up your atmosphere, the atmosphere that you breathe in order to produce a work like this?
You put it very beautifully. I really love the image of the swimming in water. It's your environment. That's your inner world. That's my inner world. The word I like to use to myself is sensibility. It's not a question so much of what intellectual interests I have, that's certainly part of it, but it's a question of like the way my sense of the world has developed throughout my life. Why did I always love literature? A sense of the depth and the complexity of what a human being is and can create, can put out into the world. And that is kind of basic to me. And along with it, there is the basic thing of my love of Torah. And that's also, it's completely together, because it wasn't that I came on one first and then the other, and I had to fit it in. I grew up within that kind of double atmosphere. I took it in the way I took it. For me, I would say it's an absolute need. It's not something I chose to do, this kind of work. It's a need to find some form of integration in the world, because otherwise the world just falls into parts. And, you specialize in this and you specialize in that. They don't really speak to each other. And I'm looking for something very, very fundamental in my life. And that I think is part of what makes me write and think and teach in the way I do. And psychoanalysis is very important to me in that sense, that it seems to offer a treasure of true thoughts. You know, I know truth is a much vexed subject now, but the thoughts that ring true to me, thoughts that answer to my own experience very largely. And I'm thinking, of course, mostly of the great psychoanalytic thinkers of the 20th century. Yes.
Well, actually, this brings me, I want to come back to your comment about the state of the humanities today. Mm-hmm. But first, let's get into the second half of the chapter, the material which first appeared in tradition and focuses largely on Parashat Kedoshim. You draw our attention to the work of Jonathan Lear. So first of all, for our listeners who may be unfamiliar, who is Jonathan Lear? What is his work?
Yes, he is an American philosopher, psychoanalyst, lives and works in Chicago. He's written many books, most of them psychoanalytic, one or two others a little different. And he brings a very wide sensibility to bear on his psychoanalytic interests, which include philosophy and simply a tremendous facility in writing. He writes in such a way that any intelligent person can engage with. It's not specialized language. And I just find that he's cleared up in my mind a lot of thorny places. You know, he clears the bush interesting pathways through the bush.
As you write that it is in this complex sense that I would describe the Israelite experience of the goat to Azazel as one of tragic irony. That's the theme that you would introduce to us from Lear. And the people's self-awareness at this moment is uncanny, out of joint, a moment of awe and truthfulness and desire for transcendence, which Lear calls aspiration. And then you bring us to a line of Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein in his very important, groundbreaking essay about is there an ethic independent of Torah? And Rabbi Lichtenstein says, with a fine sense of paradox, you point out, a Jew is also commanded to aspire. And then this becomes the aspiration, the obligation to aspire becomes part of the organizing idea around your treatment of Parashat Kedoshim with its very many, meta-halachic imperatives. So describe for us what you're doing in that part of the chapter and how this intersection, of Lear and Lichtenstein comes together to produce a distinctly Zornberg type of insight.
Well, I think what interested me most was just the very general nature, almost mystically ungrounded nature of psukim in Parashat Kedoshim, verses in the text, that like Kedoshim to you, you shall be holy, which is so open wide. What is holiness? How can you be it? How can you become it? And the other great one, of course, is you shall love your neighbor like yourself, which is in the middle of the parasha, and is in a way the central command in the Torah. I think it's right in the middle of the Torah as well. You stand on one foot, the whole of Judaism, right, is
Klal gadol b'torah.
You shall love your neighbor like yourself. And then it's these commandments, which are just so stark and so resonant, are surrounded by lots and lots of specifics, which are related to the idea of holiness and to the idea of how you behave to your neighbor, but not related clearly, right? The theme of loving your neighbor doesn't keep recurring. It sort of stands there as some kind of, the image I use is a patch of sunlight suddenly in the middle of the forest, you know, where suddenly there are no tangled roots. There's sort of moment of clarity that connects you with the cosmos. And the rest of the time you're kind of close to the ground, you know, trying to avoid all the gnarled roots of the trees and so on.
Those are the details, the rituals.
And so I'm interested in the connection between those two, the klal and the prat, the general principle and the details. Now, in general, in halachic thinking and legal thinking, we tend to go on the premise that there's nothing airy-fairy, there's nothing mystical about it, that what you do what God told you to do. And God told you what to do largely through his sages, through people who know his mind rather well because they have studied so much and thought so much. And so you follow their advice and you feel you're getting closer to God's will in the world. And there's no real room for aspiration in a sense, because, you know what you have to do and you do it. And I think what Rav Lichtenstein is saying with a fine irony when he says we are also commanded, I don't think he means as well as other people. I think he means don't get us wrong. You know, we are not just commandment obeyers. We are also aspirers. That is key to the whole enterprise.
It's not so much don't lose the forest for the trees, but don't lose the top of the tree by focusing on those gnarly roots.
Something like that. And the sunshine. And the effect of something that makes everything else make sense. You know, suddenly you have a sense of the example I give, which is a very from a different sphere, is from the film The Shawshank Redemption. Who would have thought? But there is this extraordinary moment of otherness in all the grubby, brutal details of life in a maximum security prison. Right. Where someone locks himself into the commander's room and plays Mozart over the megaphones to the prisoners who are standing around in the courtyard. And you see the immediate galvanizing effect that it has on people, how they become transfixed and with a sense of otherness, a sense of freedom somewhere reaching them from some other place. Yeah. It's really one of the most moving moments, I think, in film. Yeah. That's what I give as an example of what I think these two stark commandments, being holy and loving the other, are doing to us, and they are essential. If you know everything else and you don't know those two psukim, then you've lost the essence of the Torah.
But you point out it's obviously not quite so simple. As a matter of fact, you state that the aspiration bears a level of being actually quite unrealistic. You write that the particulars of aspiration play out in a world of pain and violence. Now, this plays back, of course, to themes that you discussed with Azazel and Chet Egel and other things. It's not so still waters and green pastures and, you know, a world in which our neighbors are always quite lovable. there'd be no reason to obligate us to love our neighbors if everybody in fact was quite lovable. Love your neighbor as yourself, reduced to three words. This is the great ethical commandment from the center of Leviticus. It addresses us with a demand for radical empathy. But the problem, of course, is that the noble principle is unrealistic. And then you survey some of the classical commentators on, you know, what this ideal means when turned into practice. But then you arrive you bring us back to the level of aspiration. You mediate the two levels of the klal gadol and the aspiration and the quite difficult nitty-gritty implementation, the gap between the ideal and the real, and you arrive at a kind of, you know, interesting statement about human nature. And here again you see that we're sitting at the intersection of Torah text and rabbinic interpretation and psychoanalysis, and I think there's a poem of William Blake that are all brought together to offer new understanding. And I think that's quite fascinating.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, my understanding of you should love your neighbor, Reacha, is not your friend. It's anything but your friend. It's just someone you happen to be find yourself together with. It could be for the principle is applied to condemned prisoners who are have to be given capital punishment. The proof text is you should love your other as yourself. What does that mean? Choose for him a humane death. In other words, your other is really someone who is absolutely different from you. He has nothing in common with you, but you find the commonality. What would I want in such a situation? My way of reading ultimately is not that you should love him as much as yourself, but you should love the Rea, the other, who is yourself, who is like yourself. Mm-hmm. Find the sense of common humanity, particularly and precisely where the differences are so glaring. You know, a man should be careful, you know, how he courts a woman, you know, how he marries a woman, because she is other than him. And that's the dangerous thing, that one has to learn somehow to overcome that obvious objectifying that can happen. So I see virtue very much in the psychoanalytic sense as in some way the attempt to remedy the natural proclivities to the opposite. And strangely, there's a kind of mystical quality about that, it seems to me. It doesn't have to be a kind of ongoing ray of sunlight throughout one's life. Mm-hmm. It's actually struggling in the midst of life with all the difficulties, the thorns, mm-hmm. Because of some kind of deep sense of transcendence in the personal, in these difficult
interpersonal. That's why you call it mystical.
Yes. It's a different way of seeing another person. In spite of and because of the difference.
Quite interesting. I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier, which I think we inadvertently touched on. I had kind of mentioned, you know, often, when I pick up a new book, the first thing I'll do is I'll go to the index, and because I think you can get a sense of you know where the author is leading you by who you're liable to encounter. So, you know, this is a book where you know if you start at A, you find Rabbi Abahu and Rabbi Akiva. And, you know, you get to, let's say, Aristotle, and then you get to Baal Shem Tov, but you find Gaston Bachelard and Rabbeinu, next to Rabbeinu Bachia. And then there's Roland Barthes, and there's Borges, and then there's the Burning Bush. And that's just the taking us through A and B. And this, again, plays to our conversation about the, let's say, the aquarium in which you swim, the atmosphere, which you breathe, and then can pass on to your readers. And we touched on this kind of question of the current state of the humanities. One only gets a work like this. One only achieves the types of insights to Torah and humanity represented in a book like The Hidden Order of Intimacy and your other works if you've been swimming in that lake, if you've been breathing that atmosphere. And you described you mentioned earlier and on some other occasions you've described your own kind of let's say intellectual biography of how you became the thinker and teacher and writer that you are, but I think that we're both aware that there's kind of great concern about the state of the humanities, both in education proper but also in the type of self-education and self-building that each of us has to engage with. I often think of the amount of teaching that you do and the amount of time I know you dedicate, serious time, to your writing, but how much time must go into continuing to stoke the fire and to put fuel into the furnace, and how much reading and rereading has to go on in order to produce chapters like these. But that is an increasingly difficult endeavor for so many because of different trends in higher education, different trends in, well, frankly, different economic trends. How do you see the state of things in, let's say, in our religious community today, and our relationship to the humanities, to maybe what once was organized around the slogan of Torah Umada, and related ideas?
That's a very complex question. Officially, we're doing very well, I think.
You got the memo.
there are wonderful institutions that are take us as assume higher education, doctorates even, in specialized subjects, as well as, of course, Torah learning. And really, women are achieving tremendous things in Talmud
Absolutely.
Torah. That's way beyond, what I've achieved, my generation in general. And it's admirable. It's the amount of effort that goes into that, and it's the opposite of what we're talking about, the kind of concentrated effort that goes into that. I think there is a loss as well, which partakes of the general malaise of our time, which has to do with kind of a dispersion, not a concentration, a dispersion of knowledge, in the sense that we're so busy,
And
so
so
we get a lot,
distracted.
and so distracted. I think we get a lot of our knowledge from previously digested, abstracts of various kinds. We read summaries of things. It puts us in touch with some of the larger flows of what's going on in the world. I think gradually we're getting seduced away from that sense of being in the full flow of creative ideas. You read the books and not the summaries. You read the books, and then the books lead you to other books. There's no substitute for that kind of actual burrowing in deep. You can get a version of it, and an easier version of it, but the result is an impoverishment. There's no question in my mind. And for me, I think the one thing I would like to see is a sense of aspiration. That is, all right, I know I can't achieve everything I would like to achieve, but at least I want to want it. I want to still keep recognizing there's a value there. There's a value in being more that kind of person, the person who is seriously following up the ideas, not just using the ideas to put on a good show,
What a very lovely way to tie it back to the theme that we were talking in the chapter again, of love, holiness, and the other appeared in the winter 2021 issue of Tradition and is available at traditiononline.org to our readers. But we commend to everyone's attention The Hidden Order of Intimacy, Reflections on the Book of Leviticus from Shokan Press, which is available, of course, in print or an audiobook edition read by the author. And it's I think, a wonderful companion to take us through the Book of Vayikra, which we are now beginning to read. So for this great offering that you've presented us, Aviva, we're very grateful, and for all of your teaching and writing and thinking and your example about the topics we've been discussing and others, we are grateful. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.